Before I give my address, I wish to make a statement of general disclaimer. The views I express here are radical, but they are simply my own views, nothing more. Unitarians do not claim to speak on behalf of the denomination as a whole, or to say what is normative for all. Therefore, others may accept or reject views expressed at their entire discretion, without any fear of comeback, whichever way they decide. That is how it should be. Both liberalism and tolerance in harmonious action. Today's address, Who Was James the Elder?, was written at great speed in one day, the 9th of August last, just after and as a result of my Dublin service on the 6th of August, with its address, Can We Trust the New Testament? A question to which I gave an emphatically negative answer. I came away from that August the 6th service in part dissatisfied, in that I felt on reflection that I had been too kind towards, and hence not critical enough, of the New Testament and the versions of key events that it imparts. More I felt needed to be said to put the record straight. And that I have tried to do in today's address. I want to start this morning by posing the leading question, who was James the Elder? You may well ask whether such a person ever in fact existed, for nowhere is he mentioned in the New Testament. As we shall see, he must have existed and was originally an important figure in the gospel story. And his omission from the surviving record thus prompts the suspicion that this was a deliberate omission, for the evolving institution simply did not wish us to know about him. He was an awkward hangover from a time before the emergent authoritarian church had rationalized and sanitized for public consumption the real details of its origin and foundation myths. Let me enunciate a vital principle of detective work. When a written record is consciously modified in order to hide or suppress information, such detail is inevitably missing in the key place where it would have occurred. But unless the forger is of a high degree of cunning or intelligence, subsidiary leads will be left elsewhere as to what has been removed. And on the evidence, the early church leaders responsible for the creation of the canonical New Testament were in no way skillful forgers. They were men of great power and influence, used to being obeyed unquestioningly. If they said something was so, woe betide anyone who asked awkward questions or suspected that the truth might be otherwise. The whole history of dissent and of the Enlightenment has been of emancipation from the power of those who rigorously enforced their truth. And now, in a freer world, we are called to hunt down those surviving loose ends and to recover the ancient truths hidden and suppressed on the say-so of the authoritarians. And the story of James the Elder is one of those ancient truths, and the truth to be revealed in this case is of a shattering proportion. When I was a boy, we lived in Leicester and occasionally attended services at the Anglican Church of St. James the Less on the edge of the city's Victoria Park. James the Less was one of the junior members of the 12, so called apparently to distinguish him from the James who was the elder brother of John, the two of whom were sons of Zebedee. But actually, the Less is a misleading description, and there must over the years have been scores of Christians who have believed that James was the Less simply because he was junior to the senior James, the son of Zebedee. But that is, as it happens, incorrect. The Less was not descriptive of status or importance, but of age or seniority in relation to another family member, and hence younger. The Latin is aetate minor, younger, or aetate maior, older. Hence we have Pliny the Elder and Pliny the Younger in Latin literature, and in politics, among many other examples, William Pitt the Elder and William Pitt the Younger. The relationship involved is not necessarily of father and son, but may be of uncle and nephew, or of two male members of a family with the same name, but separated by several generations. The New Testament James, therefore, was properly James the Younger. Interestingly, the Catholic Gelasian decree of the 6th century condemns a gospel under the name of James the Younger, an interesting and rare chance survival of a truth in general suppressed. And that James could be called the Younger involves inevitably the fact that he was named after an older member of the immediate family whose name was also James. And so we return to my initial question. Who was James the Elder? For we have established, I think, beyond doubt that such a person must have existed. Let me digress for a while to consider the question of calculated suppression of information by the early compilers of the New Testament. In 1953, R.L. Brookberger wrote an important and thoughtful book about Mary Magdalene. And in it, without departing in any degree from Catholic orthodoxy, for he was an ordained Catholic priest whose writings for publication needed an official imprimatur from the censor, Brookberger raised the important question, why was mention of Bethany and its significance limited to John's gospel? And why was there such silence, reserve almost, about Bethany in the first three gospels? Brookberger was of the opinion that Mary the hairdresser, Mary of Bethany, and Mary Magdalene were one and the same person, not in itself a heretical opinion, but he felt quite unable to offer any rational explanation for the reticence in Matthew, Mark, and Luke about Bethany and the family there. Clearly, mention of Bethany risked for the early church with its revised truth touching on a raw nerve. What can there possibly have been to hide? I think the answer is simple. Staring us in the face, as it were. I have suggested previously elsewhere that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene and that she was a member of the 12. Once the early church had decided to suppress acknowledgement of Jesus' marriage and of Mary's apostolic membership, it must have been felt by some that to touch on Bethany at all risked unwelcome exposure of original truth. And so silence came to be enjoined as policy in this area. That Bethany once featured more fully may be seen from a passage of Longmark discovered at Mar Saba Monastery in 1958, in which Jesus at Bethany teaches Lazarus about the kingdom. Bethany would certainly have featured more fully in full Longmark and in original Matthew and Luke before the excisions were made by the authorities. Let me give another example of suppression of original truth. In the Gospel of Peter fragment, there is an extraordinary passage between the laying of Jesus in the tomb on Friday evening after the crucifixion and the discovery of the empty tomb on Sunday morning. Soldiers see two men in white approach the tomb and enter it, and leave a while later, supporting an injured man between them. And this version of events must also once have been present, according to the evidence, in the Gospel of the Hebrews, part of the Matthew family, and the Gospel of James. The implication is clear that Jesus did not die from his crucifixion wounds, but was helped away from the tomb alive by friends. But the emergent institution wanted a different version of events to propagate, and thus came to suppress the real facts. Manipulation of the gospel story so that these ran in accordance with the institutional leaders' wishes, rather than simply reflecting reality, involved not only calculated suppression of actual evidence, but also creative invention of false and imagined perspectives. The early Muratorian canon suggests that at one stage, some church leaders wished the Gospel of John to be the only allowed and recognized gospel for Christians. Pressures eventually led to the acceptance, too, of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But had John alone survived with its heavily modified theological perspectives, completely unoriginal to and distorting of the historical truth, the recovery of the original religion of Jesus would have been ever so much harder. So let no one imagine for one moment that the early compilers of the New Testament were honorable men in their attitudes to textual truth and integrity. They did not scruple or hesitate either to hide information or to invent it if such courses of action suited their designs. And so we return to James the Elder. James was the elder brother of Joseph. James was also the first husband of Mary and the actual father of her firstborn, Jesus, and Jesus' younger twin, Judas Thomas. Thuma from which Thomas is derived is the Aramaic for twin. But before Mary knew that she was expecting twins, James, her husband, most unfortunately, died. In accordance with Jewish law, Joseph married his brother's widow, but Joseph and Mary then discovered, before they came together, Matthew 1:18, that she was with child, Matthew 1:18 again. Later, James was born, the son of Joseph and Mary, and half-brother to Jesus. He was given the name James in honor of James, his mother's first husband, and became known as James the Younger in consequence. The church leaders suppressed these simple truths and foisted the extraordinary notions of the incarnation and virgin birth on an unsuspecting and credulous world. The time has come for us no longer to be unsuspecting or credulous. We must now insist on the original version of events, the simple and unvarnished truth. Amen.